Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
We're back. Well, sort of. We have a mini tennis podcast for you right now, live, so to speak. Catherine Whittaker and myself here. Catherine, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm all right. Brought to you in association with The Telegraph. And we're going to have a little catch-up about what's been going on, because loads has been going on. And then we've got the second part of our listener questions special that we told you about last week that we were going to carry on with until the full-on tennis starts up again. We had loads of subjects to get into at Wimbledon with Matt and Catherine, so that's what we'll be doing. And I also mentioned last week about the passing of Peter McNamara, and Catherine and I both wanted to speak about him and share some personal memories and pay some tribute of our own to him, which we'll do in a few minutes' time. But Catherine, you have been keeping a beady eye on tennis, as I have, whilst you've been in Guernsey. Guernsey looks nice.
Yeah, I feel like I could work for the Guernsey Tourist Board. I'm a big fan. Hashtag love Guernsey. Apparently is...
Yeah, you're hanging out on boats. You've been with dogs. You've been with dolphins.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure if I've had a representative experience of Guernsey or whether I am living about as high a life as Guernsey can offer. A mutual friend of ours in Guernsey laid on a wonderful, wonderful time, including a pod of about 80 dolphins.
I didn't get the invite.
And the opportunity to drive a boat. Not sail a boat. It was a rib, so not a boat that, you know, my dad would sail across the Pacific, but a blooming fun boat.
Right. Okay. So you did get on a boat, just not the boat. So we don't know whether you make the cut yet.
Yeah, but I learned how to do knots and various things with ropes, stowing and tying, and I'm running out of lingo.
So if you're listening, David Whittaker.
I learned how to do 5 different knots.
Right, okay. Well, I'd have thought that that's probably enough to get on the boat. Right. Okay, so that's what Catherine's been doing. I've been rock climbing today with my kids, and I was rubbish at it, and everything hurts. But apart from that, we've been watching tennis, and lots has happened, as I mentioned, including the split of Alexander Zverev and Ivan Lendl, which has, I mean, I guess you could say it's been coming, in as much as his results have been pretty rubbish by his standards and certainly what we expected. He's under-delivered at all the slams since they got together. He's had some really poor results on the whole, I think, since the O2, when obviously that is the high point. And Lendl has been notable mainly by his absence from many of the tournaments, certainly the big tournaments that you would expect him to be at. And it just has felt, he's felt disengaged from it all. It hasn't been working, but still, I think when we talked about it at the start of the year, I expected them to get through to the end of the year. And I thought that they would probably find a way to turn this around, but no.
Yeah, I mean, the way it's all gone down with Lendl and the sort of the staggering limp towards the inevitable breakup, I rather suspect that there's an awful lot that's gone on behind the scenes that we don't know about and might never know about. We already know there is in general a lot going on behind the scenes with Zverev, and he's being, maybe not in terms of the nitty-gritty detail, but in terms of the big picture stuff, he's being pretty open about it. And it makes me wonder if, you know, the Lendl stuff is caught up in all of that, because it sounds like realistically he's not been having meaningful input for a long time. I mean, he made the quarterfinals of the French. That was his standout result of the year. And Lendl wasn't there, apparently because of hay fever. I mean, it was a laughable situation. So I'm relieved for Zverev. I think it's a shame. I think it raises all sorts of questions. Matt's question, which he raised at the time of the appointment, which was, has he hit the Lendl button too early? I think that suddenly becomes valid again. You know, where do you go now? Now that Lendl hasn't worked, where do you go? And yeah, I mean, the week started in Hamburg with quotes coming out from Zverev about him being displeased about the amount of time Lendl was spending with his new dog when he should have been on the practice court. So yeah, not just writing on the wall. I mean, writing sort of on the carpets, ceiling, curtains, writing everywhere.
And talking behind each other's back effectively through the media in Zverev's case, much as we love it, it's not exactly a recipe for a harmonious future. I feel as though he needs a proper reboot, and I think it's interesting, in last week's show, Matt was talking about how Muguruza still carries herself as the player she was a couple of years ago when she'd won two Grand Slams, and she strides about the court as if she owns it, and which is great on one level to have that sort of presence. And I think that Zverev seems to sway between these vast extremes of looking overly entitled to have success and carrying himself like a champion, which on the Grand Slam stage he just isn't, and then at other times looking forlorn and lost, and I end up feeling quite sorry for him. And I don't really know what to think about him, because I don't naturally warm to him and his game. I don't find it enormously pleasing to just as a viewing experience. And then there are other times when I really do warm to him, and I see his vulnerability, and I'll see him, as he did the other day, be 6-2, 5-3 down and find something and just engage with the crowd and turn it around. And you know there's something in there that is better than just certainly what he's been putting out for the last 6 months. I hope it ends up being a good feel-good story once he sorts himself out. But I think it needs to come from within rather than just this expectation that somebody's going to come in and push some button. But who that's going to be, no idea.
He's still Bookie's fourth favourite for the US Open, which says more about other things than it does about Sasha Zverev.
I'm not sure how closely they're paying attention, to be quite honest, because that's nonsense.
Well, no, we're not going to fall down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say,
but
we won't go into it here. We haven't got time. So Andy Murray is in Washington, about to play mixed doubles land. He's going to play doubles with his brother, Jamie, in Washington, which I found quite a nice, pleasant surprise, because I came out of Wimbledon wondering whether we would actually see him that much this summer. I wonder whether he might just sort of take himself away and kind of be done with doubles for the time being. And clearly not. And he said when he announced that he's going to play with Jamie that he's looking forward to it, and he wants to get out in the singles court as well, and he really wants to build. So I'm really quite chuffed to see that he's going to play.
Yeah, me too. Exactly the same response. Chuffed and surprised. I suspect, and stuff that's been coming out on social media today from Washington, I suspect it also has a lot to do with the fact that being on tour, being at these events, gives him practice partners in singles. He was out there hitting with Dennis Kudler today, I believe, in singles on the practice court, and that's what he needs. He needs that match practice if he's ever going to make it back in singles, and B, he needs the data of playing top level singles to know if it's achievable, or to know what will be required if it is to be achievable. So I rather suspect, you know, as good as the facilities are that are available to him here at home, you know, what's not available to him is top 50, top 100 tennis players, and that's what he needs. And also he gets to play doubles with his brother. I'm not sure what Neil Skubsky is up to this week. Watching on the telly?
Not sure. I haven't seen whether he's in the draw or not, to be honest.
He's not
whether
in
he's
the
in
draw.
A draw.
He's not.
Okay, he's not in that one anyway. The The other element to it is, I agree with you about the data. I also feel like he's got to just give this one big go, I would have thought. This is about seeing whether it's doable or not. So he may as well throw himself into it. And if it's not going to happen, it's not going to happen, you know. But there's no point in just pacing yourself forever. You've got to build this thing. So I think he's doing the right thing overall, as much as of a wrench as it probably is to sort of go back out on the road again, you know, when he's got his family and all the rest of it. You're going to be in Montreal in a week's time, Catherine. You're going to be there for Amazon Prime Video in the UK, presenting the coverage from there. Somebody who's not going to be there is Novak Djokovic, who's announced that he's joining Federer by skipping that this time round. And actually, I think increasingly we're just seeing this with Djokovic, aren't we? He is playing where he needs to play to recharge the batteries and maximise his chances of closing this gap. Because since Wimbledon, it's just kept reoccurring to me what an incredible moment we've just witnessed in the history of tennis, that Roger Federer did not take those two match points and finds himself four slams ahead of Djokovic rather than six slams ahead. I mean, what an incredible moment.
Yeah, maybe Federer and Djokovic are going on holiday together during Montreal. Where do you think they might go?
Where would they go?
Where
maybe
do you think they would go
together?
They're not going on a boat together. Not in a confined space.
At Tennis Podcast, let us know where Federer and Djokovic would holiday together.
The moon?
I really can't. The moon. I need to put some thought into this. I will take some time.
Yeah, I mean, he's won all the Masters, hasn't he? He completed the Golden Masters last year. He completely proved me wrong at Wimbledon. The fact that he didn't play Queens put some doubt in my mind about his prospects at Wimbledon, and he's, you know, planted egg firmly on my face. So he's a bloke that knows what he's doing with his schedule, and I think, you know, it is tough playing back-to-back Masters. Is really, really tough. Madrid and Rome is tough. Cincinnati and Montreal/Toronto is tough. So it's a hard break for the tournament. I realise that, but you know, they've got, Nadal will be, you know, sharpening his teeth somewhere for that one.
He will, as will they all. And it's just such an interesting time for tennis generally. Who plays where and what the next generation of players are going to do about this situation of just having seen the gap widen rather than shrink.
One of them's going to play doubles with Nick Kyrgios in Washington this week.
Yeah. Stefanos Tsitsipas and Nick Kyrgios finally are getting it together and kind of meeting, it feels like, for the first time.
The famous now deleted tweet from Nick Kyrgios.
Yes, where he took the mick.
Yes. Apparently that was the tournament director's suggestion, that doubles partnership.
Clever.
Further adds weight to the thesis that doubles is back in fashion.
Yes. Well,
maybe Djokovic and Federer are going to be practicing doubles together somewhere.
Just imagine if they just showed up and took a wild card and played doubles and not singles somewhere. That would be great, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Anyway, it's not going to happen.
That'd be very 2019. So. Kyrgios played just doubles in Atlanta this week. I mean,
did he?
He did. Yeah.
He is different. That much we do know. One of the story that's taken my eye just quickly is was tweeted by our good man Matt Roberts today, and Charlie Eccleshare as well, with his story on the subject, which we referenced last week, from a men's perspective in the listener questions subject about why there are no openly gay male players on the ATP circuit. And in stark contrast, certainly, to the women's circuit. And one story that came out today, one just notable draw, was that Alison van Ooytvanck, who is an openly gay female tennis player, has drawn to play against her partner in the first round of a tournament, which they were trying to work out, Charlie and Matt, whether that has ever knowingly happened before. And I think they came up with Tara Moore is the only time they can remember it. But certainly a lot more progress it feels has been made on that side on the WTA circuit than has been on the ATP.
Yeah, well, I think it's long been a far more accepting place. I'm sure progress has been made, but I mean, tennis has been right at the forefront in terms of progressiveness on the women's side. But yeah, it's great. Anastasia, in terms of the women's, Anastasia Sevastova won, I think, what is the first ever WTA Tour event in Latvia. Obviously, her home country today. That's nice, isn't it?
Ah, good on her.
In Jamala.
Yes. And very sadly, Matt looks like he might get his prediction right in the newsletter because he said Taylor Fritz would win. Where are they at the moment? Is it Atlanta?
Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes, Atlanta. And he said he would win there. So Catherine and I are keeping a very close eye on the results.
I mean,
Taylor Fritz against Alex Diminor.
Badly let
Diminor
down by Dominic
scuppers.
Thiem, didn't I?
Yeah, as I was by obviously Victoria Kuzmova in Palermo, who lost in the second
first
round.
First round lost to someone I've never heard of.
Yeah. So thanks for that, Victoria. Matt, I'm angry at you again because I've never heard of her until you brought her up.
Coco Gauff's just won a round of qualifying in Washington.
Yeah. So
anyway, yeah, this is a mini pod. We can't get into qualifying.
And just to say, if you want to get on the newsletter mailing list, have a look at the show notes on your phone or your iPad or your computer, whatever you're listening to this on right now. Scroll down, you can click and sign up to our mailing list, and you'll get lots of these rubbish predictions every single week and daily at Slams. What more could you want? So before we move on to our listener questions special part two, this 2 week special. Mentioned last week about Peter McNamara, who very sadly passed away a week ago. He'd been suffering from prostate cancer for many years. And he's somebody that I had known on the Champions Tour, certainly since I first joined the tennis world. And that's the late 90s. And Peter would have been retired from the main tour by then. But he was a regular on the Champions Tour. And I just found him to be the most welcoming of people and never anything other than just friendly and happy to see you, but straightforward. You know, there was never any falseness to him at all. And just, he will be so missed by so many people on the tennis circuit. And I count myself among those. You joined the circuit later, Catherine, about 10 years later than I did in that regard. You also worked on the Champions Tour. How did you find him?
Exactly the same experience. Absolutely no side to him. A man of great warmth, extremely welcoming, but just all the sort of cliched things you'd associate with a with a textbook Aussie, really. Just, yeah, completely down to earth and no nonsense. I wasn't, you know, I knew about the Maccas, McNamara, McNamee, but I didn't know that much about his tennis. I saw a lot of him play. You know, a lot of people show up at Champions Tour events, Legends events, to see Mansour Bahrami play, and maybe a lot of them over the years didn't notice that an awful lot of time on the court when Mansour Bahrami was doing wonderful, wonderful crowd-pleasing things, at the other end of the court, it was Peter McNamara, and there was a reason for that. Mansour Bahrami always wanted to have Macca at the other end of the court. He sort of considered them a team, not just Peter McNamara. There are others as well, and of course, the more they played with him, the more they got used to setting him up for his trick shots and all the rest of it. But yeah, a man with, I mean, I'm sure he did have an ego, but it wasn't front and centre. And actually, the friend I was staying with in Guernsey, somebody that you and I both got to know on the Champions Tour, she was a great, great friend of Macca's, and shared so many stories about him this weekend. And she actually showed me a video that she made 4 years ago for his 60th birthday, where she got all of his friends, so other legendary tennis players, you know, Mansour Bahrami, Mark Philippoussis was on there, John McEnroe, Mats Wilander, all of them sent in messages for Macca to tell him how much they loved him and appreciated him, and it was, yeah, she dug it out for me to have a look at, and the, you know, these were not platitudes. It was an incredible depth of feeling there. And he was diagnosed 10 years ago, and nobody knew, or very, very few people knew. He wanted it that way, not because he was ashamed in any way, but because he wanted to keep living. And for him, that meant keeping working, keeping playing. And he didn't want to risk losing any of that by letting people know. And I hope that that didn't mean that he ever felt lonely in it. I hope not. And I don't think so. I think he had just enough important people that knew. You know, watching that video, he had an awful lot of people that thought an awful lot of him. And it's a nice thought that he was able to see that 4 years ago on his 60th birthday. So he'll be hugely missed.
He will. And just on his playing, just quickly, there's a line Pat Cash gave in an ATP Tour website piece that James Baddell wrote, talking about his tennis. And he said that Peter McNamara was a hero of his, Pat Cash did. He said he ball boyed for him. And he said he had, in his view, one of the greatest single-handed backhands he's ever seen. Thumped it with incredible power, took it on the rise, great precision. And it's one of those things that it's difficult, you know, there's not that much footage out there that you can instantly go to, but it's well worth going and looking that up, because, you know, we love great single-handed backhands, don't we? There are video montages made about Stan Wawrinka and Roger Federer and people like that that have these sort of backhands. And so, you know, it's nice to think that Peters will be hopefully looked up now by people that might hear this.
I looked it up. Yeah, just two final points. One memory that sprung to my mind. I think you were there, David. It was in the Players Lounge at the Albert Hall several years ago. It was when I think he was at the time coaching Grigor Dimitrov, and he was talking about Grigor so fondly, and he was also talking about Mark Philippoussis, who had coached a few years earlier and at a very similar stage in his career. And it just made me think, you know, there's a reason why blokes like that chose him to be their sort of guiding hand at that stage in their careers, you know, a real father figure. I'm sure both of them are pretty gutted by this news. And one final point that Sarah, who I was staying with this weekend, she said the one story he would want told about him was when a few years ago, I'm not sure exactly how many years ago, probably quite a few given how long they've been married, but he was in the Players Lounge at the Australian Open, and he clocked Pat Rafter alongside his lovely wife Lara Rafter, and Macca was so distracted by the sight of Lara Rafter, he walked clean into the wall and almost knocked himself out.
Peter
McNamara, ladies and gentlemen.
Indeed, and hugely missed by us all, and very fondly so. So, Catherine and myself will be back with another edition of the regular tennis podcast next week, but we will hand you back in time a couple of weeks ago to when we were taking our listener questions, and they're from you. And we'll leave you with that, and in the company of Catherine, myself, and Matt Roberts.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So, Alex, to be continued, our second consecutive listener question special, because we planned to do an entire show full of your questions and answers last week, and we got through three questions. So here we are again. Catherine Whittaker. Hello, Catherine.
Hello.
Matt Roberts. Hello.
Hello.
And Alex, surname?
Petalas.
Yep.
Which I think I've said differently to how I said it last week.
It was certainly closer than I would have got. Sorry, Alex, if we're wrong. Who's the owner of Rio with a Y, who is our mascot for the 2019 season of the Tennis Podcast.
Lovely canine.
A wonderful canine. And will be... we'll be kick-starting again, crowdfunding again in December. And if you want to have your pet become the Tennis Podcast mascot for 2020, you'll have your chance. But let me tell you, you better be quick. The last one went in about 10 minutes last year in the Kickstarter. So anyway, we'll see how that goes. Anyway, we have Alex as our guest editor of the Listener Questions Special. Once a year. However, as we say, we didn't get through all the questions. We got through three of them. 17 minutes on Garbini Muguruza, I thought, was really impressive. And so we've got loads more questions to get through today. So, Matt, kick us off.
So, Alex's next question is, with Wimbledon having purchased the golf course across Church Road, what would your ideal expansion master plan look like? What does Wimbledon look like in your minds in a few years' time when they've got that land?
How detailed do we need to go?
As detailed as you like.
We can do whatever we want, Catherine, you and me.
I'm not a town planner.
what features have you seen at other slams,
Could they extend Roland Garros into the golf club at Wimbledon? Because that's the one that needs extending.
Now, that would be a heck of a big extension.
Yeah.
Across the channel.
I mean, look, I'm all for slams creating more space. I don't like walking around Grand Slams when they're full of people, and it makes me feel really stressed out.
Yeah, people, leave.
The US Open isn't like that, but
they've got
the Australian Open is less like that, yeah, because they've got more space. But I suspect they'll just let more people in.
Well, they will,
Tandem with the having more space. I hope I'll be wrong. I hope it will enable the tournament to breathe a bit more in the way that the hard court slams do. My fear is that they'll just let more people in.
The big news is that they plan to bring qualifying away from Roehampton.
I love
on
Roehampton
site.
Qualifying.
I know you love it.
They let dogs in.
Everybody loves it who goes. But that's not many people.
I know the players don't like it.
And
but
it doesn't make
really
a lot of sense.
Great.
It is one of the great sights in tennis, the Roehampton qualifying, where you stand, if you stand at the back of the back of the courts, and there's literally tennis as far as the eye can see. There's 10 courts, tennis going on, it's got a real atmosphere and vibe to it.
And the fact that it's not at the site of the Grand Slam that they're aiming to qualify for makes the rawness of it feels exaggerated.
It's like you have to win here to get to the kind of promised land kind of thing.
Exactly.
It is a throwback.
The Yellow Brick Road.
It is what tennis used to be, but it's time to change that. I think it is.
Did I mention that they let dogs in?
Maybe they'll let dogs in to this new
one. All right, well, I'm sold. It's really all I want.
They've
from
got all
tennis
the security dogs, so why wouldn't they?
I must say, having been to the French Open and arriving there a few days before the tournament started, I did see the value in having the qualifying on site at the venue, because I was watching a qualifier match on one of the larger outside courts, and you had probably 2,000 people watching this qualifying match, and it did sort of break you into the tournament, and it thought, okay, Roland Garros is starting now. People are coming to the venue. They're already interested in Roland Garros, even though the main draw hasn't started. Did and it added to the experience.
Do they let people in for free?
I don't know about
because that's a great thing.
If it's free, then
yeah, it
great.
Is cool, that.
I don't know.
Look, let's be honest. The qualifying events at Slams are fantastic. Mm. They are. If you ever get to go to them, do it, because it's a tournament within itself, and this means the world to these players if they manage to get into the main draw. The huge amount of prize money if they get into the main draw, loads of points, and they have to win three matches. It's a real journey all of its own. And the tennis is incredible. You can get closer up a lot of the time. Mm. They're starting to stream all these courts, aren't they, as well now on TV. I think that they need to make more of these qualifying events.
I agree. I mean, the thing that I'm... The defining feature of sport that I love is when it matters.
Yeah.
The more it matters, the more I'm interested in it. It doesn't really matter what the sport is. And qualifying wins matter to those people in them almost as much, if not as much, as Grand Slam wins matter to those that are winning Grand Slams. It's not for everyone, you know. In some qualifying matches will feature, I don't know, there's the full gamut of competitors in them, but for some of them it is life and death. They're trying to earn enough to sustain them for another year on tour.
Yeah.
You know, for some of them, if I don't qualify for this Grand Slam, I will have to give up being a professional tennis player. It's life and death. It's everything, and that's
life and death
really
as
all
a career,
I want from
certainly.
Sport.
Yeah.
That's
Can I just say as well? Go on, Matt.
I was just going to say that the story of Wimbledon week one this year was born out of qualifying. Coco Gauff. I mean, she came through qualifying and it was cool for us, and how cool must it have been if you were there on day one of qualifying to see Coco Gauff start that journey and what she would then go on to do. You know, what a great story that is to say, oh, I saw her in qualifying.
You'd be one of those irritating early adopters going, well, I saw her when she was in the first round of qualifying and I knew she
more.
Was going to be a really big thing.
Yeah, exactly that. Very good impersonation, girlfriend. I don't know who that was, but just generic
annoying
smug
human.
And annoying.
Generic
yeah.
irritant. Okay. Can I? The other things in terms of what we would like to do with the expansion, I would like to see. I think it's a fantastic opportunity for Wimbledon to fill in all the gaps that are currently there in terms of helping create the next generation of people that are interested in the sport, to really get kids involved, to do a kids' day. They did the middle Sunday tennis opened up alongside the LTA this year, which was nice to see a proper partnership there and some real forward planning to try to create more interest in the sport. I just feel that this is an opportunity. I don't know whether they'll do that, but it does seem like an opportunity.
Well, Michael Downey told it. I know he's not the chief executive of the LTA anymore, and this very well may have changed, and maybe a view on this is something we should pursue. But I remember Michael Downey telling us that I think I asked him about his day, and he said it wasn't commensurate with the brand of Wimbledon, and that made me really sad, because this is the only slam that doesn't have a kids' day, and it's a desperate shame, because as much as I hate being at them, I see the kids' days at other Grand Slams, and they are so powerful.
I think that they're moving closer to it. When I see that middle Sunday event that they had, I think that there is...
Good, okay.
It feels to me, anyway, there's certainly obviously huge determination from an LTA British tennis perspective to try to move that direction, but Wimbledon obviously has its own, to use that word, brand. But when they've got that much more space... I would be really disappointed as well if that wasn't used and factored in as a way to create more interest for young people who maybe can't afford to get tickets to this place.
I think it will be interesting how they use that space and make it still feel connected to the current site we have. I think it's going to take some interesting architectural and sort of planning to make it feel like part of the same tournament? Because it is, it's quite a way, you know, it's across the road. It's, and I think even the new Simone Mathieu court at Roland Garros, which by all accounts was a big success and a nice court, but it felt like a different tournament when you were over there, because it was kind of cut off from the rest.
It was far away.
It was far away, and you know, the good point about it is it was less crowded over there. It was a haven almost, but it did feel like a different tournament, didn't? And they're going to have to use the space creatively, I think, to make it still feel like the same tournament.
Architecturally, I have 100% confidence in Wimbledon to achieve everything they need to, because all the architectural changes that have been made to this place over the years have just been sublime. They've been 100% success. The roof, the courts, everything. Architecturally,
they've done
just
a great job
it.
Of modernising without you really noticing what they've done.
It
still has the same feel about Wimbledon, and yet if you actually went back and looked at the old facilities, they would be night and day. So I agree with Catherine totally there. But, you know, we'll wait and see exactly what they prioritise, because there will be a need for them to create more hospitality, I'm sure. There'll be all sorts of things like that. But I would really hope that they would take this as an opportunity and run with it.
Just to make it a more inclusive place, you know. Tennis still has a problem with being stiff upper lip, being upper middle class sport in this country. You know, use the space to... I'm sure you can't solve all the problems with, you know, buying a bit of extra golf course space, but make that a goal. Make that a goal of all of it, to make it just completely achievable for anybody that wants to come to Wimbledon to be able to come to Wimbledon, because it's wonderful and it shouldn't be something that's just open to the elite or people that are able to sack off their AS levels for a week and come and queue, which is what I did. You know, there are joyful things about all of that, but it's not inclusive, and I want tennis to be inclusive.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would say, I still don't 100% agree with you about the queue, because you can queue. If you want to come, you can queue. Circumstances
asterisk,
can be difficult for people. I
asterisk
understand
if your circumstances allow it.
Yeah. Okay, we've had this argument. So we won't waste another 20 minutes of another podcast with it. So that's one question done. 12 minutes. We're doing well. Come on.
So Alex has now chosen a few questions from social media. This one from David Blanchard, who prefaces it with potentially a contentious one.
David?
Has Venus Williams underachieved in her career? He says, no French Open's one thing, considering her style of play, but compared to her Wimbledon and US Open achievements, her Aussie Open record is a bit average, is it not?
Hadn't even occurred to me that Venus Williams might be an underachiever. And that's fine.
I think you have to bear in mind her longevity for a start. I mean, she played her first professional match in, I think, 1994, when she was 14. Right, it's 25 years ago.
That's before I was born.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a single match. And the first time I really became aware of, I mean, I'd read reports about her in the mid 90s when Matt still wasn't born. But I saw her play her first US Open. I think it was her first US Open, and she reached the final of it in her first US Open. It was amazing. It was amazing to witness it, and the reaction of America. I think she lost to Martina Hingis in the final. And I think you have to bear in mind that she was sharing an era at the start there with Martina Hingis and some really, you know, a very young up-and-coming Martina Hingis and Monica Seles and players like Jennifer Capriati. And there were some really, really good players. And then Kim Clijsters and Justine Henin came along. And there was a depth. And then obviously her sister came along too. So there were so many great, really, really high-quality players. That's one. She won five Wimbledons and she won those a long time ago. She hasn't won a Wimbledon for 10 years. So five Wimbledons in that first, basically, 8 years of her career or so. She won a couple of US Opens, and that's good. And there was Lindsay Davenport as well in that era as well. I do think that it's an underachievement for her not to have won an Australian Open. I think that that was perfectly set up for her. She did lose in the final to her sister. So, again, you're running into your sister. And then let's not forget, she's had some real ill health in the last decade, the autoimmune disease that she suffered from, other things and so forth. I think I would have thought she would have won more. If you had asked me at the outset of her career, I probably would have expected her to win double figures of slams. But then I didn't think her sister would win 23 of them. So she's taken a lot of the slams that big sister, I think, would have won.
Yes, I agree with that. And I do just wonder whether... I think her hunger to be out there and compete and just... be on a tennis court is without question, but I wonder if her hunger to be at the very top and dominate has been tempered by the fact that to do that would be for a large chunk of her career have been displacing her sister, not consciously necessarily, but subconsciously, especially because she's the older sibling.
And even in their matches, I mean, I still feel a bit sick when I think about the accusations that used to get thrown around when they first played each other about how people thought, oh, they're just deciding who wins this week and you win next week. I really always hated that at the time, and I still hate it now. But I do feel that probably Venus Williams, and I don't know her, but my sense is that she would have struggled with the ruthlessness to beat her sister, that her sister managed to find the other way. And that doesn't mean she loves her any more or any less.
I think that's maybe a part of, I hope Math isn't listening, but maybe the difference between being an older sibling and a younger sibling.
I agree.
I think that is significant.
And there will be exceptions. I'm sure there are people out there listening to this saying, well, I'm. It's not
of
like that in my family.
Of course there are, but as a younger sibling, you're used to chasing and aspiring and wanting to be.
And an older sibling, my sense is that you're more used to putting an arm around and nurturing and looking after. More naturally.
Are you an older sibling or a younger sibling, Matt?
I'm a younger sibling.
Yeah. Are we all younger siblings?
I'm a younger one and I'm a pain in the arse.
We're all younger siblings. That's chasers. Why we're all saying this. We're all chasers.
I think the Venus statistic that always jumps out at me is that she only had 11 weeks as number one. But so when you dig into that, the ranking system was different then. And I think she finished number three in 2000 and 2001, despite having won Wimbledon and the US Open both those years. And I think the ranking system then rewarded much more quantity of events over the quality of the events that you won. And she was up against players like, as you were saying, David, all those players that she had, Hingis, Capriati, who were just playing more than her. And so maybe she never got the weeks at number one that sort of she deserved or merited. And even though the players saw her as the dominant player, I mean, John Wertheim wrote that book, didn't he, Venus Envy? She was the dominant player at the time, and you know, I missed her peak years really, but everyone that I speak to now who watched her in the early 2000s and late 90s will say Venus was unbelievable. You know, I put up on Wimbledon during Wimbledon on Twitter, I said, who are the best movers in WTA history? And everyone came back to me. Venus Williams at her peak was the best mover. She could cover the court in two strides.
Someone said peak Heather Watson.
Someone did say peak Heather Watson, which I think was a joke. But
she's a good mover, but yeah. There are levels.
No, it was vintage Heather Watson.
Sorry, vintage Heather Watson.
Yeah.
Unspecified what vintage that was.
So I feel sort of difficult to comment on Venus, having not seen her in her absolute peak, but I do get the sense that maybe she could have won more in those early years. But as you said, there were so many other good players at that time as well that they were taking titles off each other.
Yeah, I mean, we often talk about the depth now and the ability of players to win at slams. But back then, it felt like that you basically got 6 to 8 multiple Grand Slam champions, and they were all playing pretty much at the same time. And yeah, it was the only one who was able to stick out head and shoulders above everybody else was Serena Williams, but she actually got better as she went along, whereas I think Venus had her period and then it tailed off through one reason or another, and obviously then she had the ill health. So did she underachieve? I find it really hard to put it in a little box like that. I
think
feel
it's possible that there was a period of her career where she maybe underachieved a bit at the Australian Open, but I think overall, I think given the Sjögren syndrome, which is a really massive thing, a really, really massive thing, it's similar to lupus, and because it's a condition which manifests itself in flare-ups, we don't know when to attribute something to the condition and when to not. We don't want to do her a disservice by saying, oh, it's a very tricky one for us to say, for us to bring up the condition that she suffers from, because it might be that she was feeling fine that day and she just lost because of nothing to do with it. But overall, in the context of the last 10 years, I think she's overachieved. So maybe on balance, she's just achieved.
Yeah.
And if you're counting it in terms of Grand Slams, over the last 20 years, who has won more Grand Slams than Venus Williams? Serena. I mean, yeah, she's won.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
She won more than Sharapova. She's got more than, I mean, maybe the same as Ennan. I think maybe they've both got 7. But you know, it's Serena who's got more, and to say that she's underachieved when she's got the second most amount of Grand Slams in the last 20 years doesn't feel right.
I also do feel that whenever you look at a career, you do need to bear in mind what they do in these years where she really doesn't need to be playing the sport, when she's playing several years here, late 30s, and chances are she isn't going to win another slam, but she still goes out there. I mean, at the start of Wimbledon, I know she lost against Coco Gauff first round, but she was writing tweets saying, I've got ants in my pants, I'm so excited about playing Wimbledon again at the age of 39. And I don't know. I remember the first US Open she played in 1997, 22 years ago. Mm. And she was, if somebody had told you in those first 5 years of her career that she'd still be playing nearly 40, when people really did, I'm afraid, sneer because she had outside interests, because she had her own clothing company, because her and her sister had other business interests, it really winds me up. Nobody ever does that about other players. They always say about Serena and Venus Williams, oh, well, they've got so many other interests. But they say it as a negative. Mm-hmm. And it's not a negative. It shows how impressive they are, that they can multitask, that they've got more than just tennis. And yet, they are outstaying everyone in tennis. And
perhaps because of those outside interests, as much as, you know, not in spite of them, because of them. That's what
I kind of feel. There's a lot of people out there, and I probably include myself in this, that owe those two an apology from back then, because I'm quite sure that would have come out of my mouth 15 years ago when talking about maybe how sparingly they're playing, and I cringe at that thought now.
And yeah, what you were saying, Catherine, about if there was a small period of underachievement, let's not forget 2 years ago, I can't think of a season from a player in my tennis watching time that a player who has almost overachieved so much. Venus reaching the Australian Open final, the Wimbledon final, the US Open semi-final, the WTA finals final, I think,
yeah,
at 37 years
absolutely
old.
And which Sjögren syndrome.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary season. I've
forgotten that.
And I don't think we give that season enough credit, because
absolutely,
because it didn't end in a victory anywhere, but it was a hell of a season.
We do it here on the Tennis Podcast. We've just done it.
Next comes from Grant, who says, which player has surprised you most in 2019 in good or bad ways?
Whew, there's been a lot of both. Do you want to take the positives, David? We revert to the mean?
I feel like I'll give you a little selection of people because I've done no pre-planning here at all. But I'll give you... there's a few people that spring immediately to mind. I've been very pleasantly surprised to some degree by Stefanos Tsitsipas. Not that he's shown a level that he's shown, but that he beat Roger Federer at the Australian Open. And then he backed it up and he kept on producing. Okay, he hit a bit of a wall from the French Open onwards to where we're talking to you now around the grass season. But I think that was great to see somebody just burst out of the pack of the next gen and actually do something meaningful and do it a few times. I think Félix Auger-Aliassime has been a real find in that regard as well. These are just players, I think, that are just ahead of the schedule a little as to where I thought they would be. Alexander Zverev's a massive disappointment. Massive disappointment.
Denis Shapovalov.
Yeah, he is disappointing. Garbiñe Muguruza, who we talked about in the last show, should not be in the 20s in the world.
Arina Sabalenka.
Oh, that's a good one.
Crikey, yeah.
Really disappointing. And what worries me about her is I'm not... I mean, this is falling into the trap of reading too much into people's social media, which only tells a fraction of the story, but if you just go by her social media, she isn't really facing up to what a catastrophe this season has been. Really, I mean, it has, and I was aware, I was prepared for a bit of a letdown after the end of that season. I think we talked it in some of our podcasts at the end of the 2018 season about how frustrating it must be for players that have a brilliant end of season and then have to take a break from it, and they must just want to keep on going. Zverev would, I'm assuming, would absolutely fall into that category, much as I'm sure he enjoyed his holiday in the Maldives. It probably would have been best for him to press on from the O2.
Not that many do that well at the end of the year and then really well straight away.
But I would have expected Sabalenka to turn the ship around a little bit. I mean, it feels like the ship is just weighted down.
Yes.
At the moment. It's getting... It's getting worse, not better.
What's the question again?
Players who have surprised us in good or bad ways this year.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think Sabalenka in
a
bad way.
I had her in my Australian Open final.
I mean, obviously, Coco Gauff is a great find. But actually, I suppose the player that surprised me by just... because I hadn't had a chance to see her at this level was Bianca Andreescu. Mm. And... it also surprises me that we're sitting here at Wimbledon recording this, having seen her breakthrough 3-4 months ago, and nothing's happened since because of that awful shoulder injury that she's got. The thought that somebody of that age has got an injury like that, and we don't know how and when she's coming back, that really, really upsets me, really.
Yeah, and if we're on injury, we should probably... mentioned Del Potro.
Yeah. I can barely
do so without
obviously
getting
a
bit upset.
That's very sad. It's not that much of a surprise because his body can go at any time. It's more of a surprise that Andy Murray's back. Isn't it? In a positive sense.
Yeah.
Come on, we'd retired him at the Australian Open.
Yeah.
I remember us having the podcast after his first round or so, when I was trying to say, but I think he can get through to Wimbledon. But you did, and you said, yeah, but look, we're talking about his retirement. Nothing's changed just because he's going to try to get through to Wimbledon. He's retiring, and we all felt the same about that. We all thought this is it. It's over. And
he presented it as either I limp through into Wimbledon or I have this surgery and it's it's retirement. And I think that's how he needed to see it at the time, right? Because that's what he said subsequently. I chose the surgeon for the hip resurfacing surgery on the basis of who was most honest with me. And I asked him before Queens, I said, you know, you've said this about how you chose your surgeon. Does that mean you had to come to terms with the worst case scenario? And he said, the worst case scenario for me was... but I was living it. I was living the worst case scenario. He expected not to play again.
Yeah.
For sure, he expected not to play again. He saw taking that route as retiring and everything being a bonus. And I'm sure that's an element of that is mental mind games, because you have to be okay with the worst case scenario. And if he'd gone into that thinking, oh, but maybe I can come back, it's not the right frame of mind, is it? It's not. And you can see that from how just gleeful he is at just being pain-free, because that's all he ever wanted. He got to the stage where that's all he needed,
yeah,
was to get rid of the pain.
And then he had a chat with Bob Bryan and everything's fine. So, Matt, what about you?
I have three players. One we've already mentioned, Zverev. I really thought something had changed at the O2 last year, but I think we said it on the podcast at the O2 last year. It felt different because he'd beaten Federer and Djokovic back-to-back to do it. That felt so significant. That's what we've been crying out for this whole time, is one of those next-gen to displace the current big three. And he did that at the O2 with really stunning tennis. He was exceptional in both those matches. Where has that been? And obviously he has had this whole management crisis. And
what
all
do you
that
think
going
about
on.
That? The fact that he's latterly started being quite honest with us about stuff that's going on. He talks about them. I mean, I think in a couple of his German press conferences at Wimbledon, he was incredibly honest about the situation that's going on with his former manager Patricia Appé and all the consequences of that. He said he's having to act as a lawyer. You know, he talked about his irritation, that's probably an understatement, at, you know, Washington not wanting to pay his appearance fee anymore, all of that stuff. He said his dad's had ill health, he said he's broken up with his girlfriend, etc. How sympathetic with you how sympathetic with him are you about that? Do you think, well, that's life? Or, like, you know, Federer, Nadal, Murray, they've all gone through periods where they've gone through that, and we haven't seen it reflected on the court as much as we have with you.
On a
or
human
do you
level,
think...
I feel a bit sorry for him, because whenever... I do feel... Zverev is not somebody over the years that I've really warmed to on the court, and I haven't got hugely excited about him, to be honest. And, I love it when new players come along and we can just talk about potential, etc. Maybe there's a bit of me that just heard so many people banging on about how he's going to be the next number one in the world that I've sort of maybe railed against that. I'm not 100% sure, but I haven't... He hasn't kind of enchanted me in the way that he plays the game either. I find it fairly run-of-the-mill a lot of the time. And then you'll see the occasional shot with the particularly with the backhand where you go, wow, that's amazing. And also I quite like it when he gets the crowd involved. But I feel that there's almost been a little bit of presumption from him and everybody else that it'll just happen, almost a sort of an entitlement that I haven't always liked. But then you see, I quite like his bluntness in press conferences. I enjoy that. But I also see the real, or what I suspect is the real human behind him when he's sad, and he kind of lets you, he doesn't sugarcoat it.
He's sad and he's just sort of a kid.
Yeah, and I do see him interviewed sometimes or give a speech on the court, and I kind of want to just put my arm around him a bit and just say, it's all right, you'll get there, you'll be all right.
Do you believe that?
So where it comes...
That he'll get there and he'll be all right?
I'm not sure. No, I'm not sure. And as regards the agent thing, yes. Look, it's your own fault, really, mate. You know, you signed up to this, so I don't know.
Is that true, or did you know? We're talking about. I mean, I believe Osaka's been in a a similar situation, not quite as dramatic, but she's been sued by a former coach from when she was a very young junior. Because we're talking about deals that are done when these people are still legally children.
I understand that, and we haven't seen the paperwork, so we don't know what was agreed and when, by whom, etc. We don't know all those things. But look, the fact is, if you have a contract, you have a contract. And so there's a degree to which you've just got to deal with it or get out of it and pay whatever it is. I don't know all the details. So a bit of me thinks, well, that's black and white one way or another. But yes, on a human level, I do feel a bit sorry for him, and I do hope that it works out, because I'd like to see the best of him, whatever that is.
Just picking up on that point that you mentioned about kind of entitlement and that kind of thing, that it will happen eventually. I read quite an interesting column from Tony Nadal during Wimbledon, in which he was saying that he thinks the very existence of the next gen as a concept is actually negative for them, because
how Nadal is that as a response to the next gen, the person who never looks beyond the next point.
And he was saying that by bracketing them all as this next gen, that in itself was suggesting that they are the next big thing, that they are good, and that they're also necessary for the sport. And he thinks that has held them back in a way. And particularly something he was saying was that he thinks that they don't deal with adversity as well as Nadal, Federer, that generation do. And that would play into this, how much this management situation has affected him. He's not able to deal with negative situations as well as the older players.
Yeah, I suppose if you do look up and every 5 seconds you've got an advertising campaign saying you're the next gen, you are the next big thing, effectively, it will happen. Mm. It's pretty hard to understand that actually, no, in order for it to happen, I have to do this, and this every single day of my life. Mm. And I think that we are all guilty here on the Tennis Podcast of this sometimes in underappreciating just what goes in to these players producing the performances that they produce. We will sometimes quite in a blasé manner say, oh well, he's not going to beat him because that guy always he's a great player, he always wins. There is so much to the process every single day for these guys. Federer doesn't just turn up and just swish the ball about.
I'd love to see more of it though, because you hear so many oblique references to hard work, and I accept that on a conceptual level. I know conceptually hard work goes into that, but until you actually see it and taste it,
they could do a better job of communicating that.
It's quite hard.
Federer doesn't really want people to know too many of the details, I think, and he released that Luca Puy practice video, didn't he, when he was coming back? But that's kind
Which
of
I
all
found
we ever get
just,
to see.
I mean, I was glued
that
to
was
that.
Fascinating.
Absolutely glued to it.
Yeah.
Was that live?
It was a live Periscope. I think he was in Dubai.
It was
the end of the 2016 season, and okay, we talk about all that hard work, but the main thing that came across was how much fun he was having, just hitting tennis balls. He's
always been like that on the practice court since he was a kid, because I've been around that, including playing with him once. Didn't go very well from my perspective.
Garbiñe Muguruza might be listening.
Garbiñe Muguruza, if you want to coach, available. Honestly, it was all Federer. I mean, this was before Federer was winning slams, so he was still 19. It was all he could do. He was stifling laughter basically throughout.
I've been there, Rog.
Can I just say two other players who have surprised me?
Oh, yes.
In a negative way, Angelique Kerber. I think in our start of the year predictions, I think I had her as finishing possibly number one. I thought she was going to have a really good season because she looked so good and so fit and so strong at the start of the season in the Hopman Cup, which I know maybe lesson. Note to self, don't draw conclusions from the Hopman Cup, although there is no Hopman Cup anymore, so I won't be doing that. But the mixed doubles final, Switzerland versus Germany, and that Kerber was, it's still one of the best matches I've seen this season. Kerber was going toe-to-toe with Federer, and I just thought she looked so good and so primed to have a good season, and yet she's had these slam results where she keeps getting completely blown away.
Danielle Collins, remember that?
Yeah, and it was Potapova in Roland Garros, and she keeps just getting blown off the court, and I didn't expect that. But then in a good way, Ash Barty, I mean, I know David predicted her to win a slam, but that, which was not at year's start. And I felt like she made such significant progress.
Listen to this. Can't even give me the credit for that.
But don't you think she made such significant progress through the first 3 months of this year that she put herself in a position where that was a plausible prediction? She's backed it up. And
more than plausible.
And Ash Barty is number one. I mean, we wouldn't have thought that 6 months ago.
Actually, you know
we
what?
Really would.
That's probably the biggest surprise, isn't it? Let's be honest. Because that has come out of more or less nowhere. I only thought she was going to win a Grand Slam when I saw her. I think maybe
is
on
it
the
Miami?
Clay. Actually, it was coming out of Miami onto the clay, and I just felt like all the components now were in place.
And she'd had a good Fed Cup, hadn't she, where she'd just sort of propelled Australia through and shown that grit and that determination. That's what I always thought was missing from Ash Barty, that kind of match toughness in a way. She's always had the nice game, but now she's able to back it up with a winning formula as well.
Yeah.
Time for one more question, Matt.
Okay. They fly by these, don't they?
Okay.
Choose carefully.
So, let's go with this one. Tab Farmer, which I'm guessing is a username, was on Instagram and wants to know, have David and Catherine ever had a proper falling out?
When did we meet? 12 years ago?
2007.
Yeah, 12 years
Queens,
ago.
Queens, 2007.
Yeah.
I had braces.
Yep, correct. I had brown hair. Those are the days. We've had some absolutely fantastic rows about all manner of things. We have argued a lot over the last decade.
On air and off.
WhatsApp has not been in many ways a brilliant invention, but also...
there are some quite sensational periods of silence on WhatsApp, which are probably the climax of a row, when we've definitely gone at a good 24, 36 hours where nobody has replied. And then it certainly feels to me like it's a kind of staring out contest to see who's going to look away first and give in.
It definitely helps now that we have a group WhatsApp that Matt, as moderator, is part of, don't you think?
Yes.
Is it?
Although
is it,
you are fantastically good at silence.
Matt just
at keeping out. Oh, I sense danger.
there was one I don't even remember what the subject was, but I just remember one thing flared up. It really flared up. And Matt, who'd been a perfectly nice kind of jovial part of the conversation, just suddenly disappeared from it. And these messages were flying backward and forwards with just great ferocity, and neither one of us was prepared to give way at all. And Matt, I guess, was just a sort of viewer.
It's great entertainment. Yeah, I just see it. I get a front row seat.
And then what happens in the WhatsApp group now, which never used to happen, is at some point we get so exasperated with one another that we'll say, Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, and then I'm forced to give an opinion on something, knowing that one of them is going to be incredibly upset about whatever I say.
And he'll give the most non-committal. You do a splendid job of just kind of slightly calming it down. We've had some big debates. Have we ever had any massive falling out? No.
Well, you said that an argument was the genesis of the podcast.
That's true. Yes, in 2008.
This story doesn't reflect what
it took.
I mean,
4 years. It took 4 years for it to become the podcast from this moment. But I mean, Catherine was my intern at back then in the second year of her career, and she was still at university. And we were in the Queen's Bar, group of us, and we were talking about, I don't even know what. Roger Federer came up, and Catherine said something about Federer being, I think, unrelatable and being too perfect and having no sort of, almost as though you were saying that he didn't have a human side to him.
Well, like what my brother reminded me of on the anniversary of Federer Roddick the other day. He just doesn't need it, Matt.
Yes, so
that was how I used to feel about Federer.
Yeah, so
he doesn't
this is
need it.
2008, when he was, you know, pretty much at his dominant best. Admittedly, he had just had that French Open final, but that's what Catherine was getting at. And I of course had seen a couple of years earlier Federer sobbing on the shoulder of Rod Laver, which I found one of the most moving images in tennis that I'd ever seen. And equally, and I know this sounds terrible because A, it's name dropping, and B, it's, oh, well, I know him. I hate that sort of stuff. But the fact is I did know him, or I had had an experience with him in his early career, and I knew what I was talking about, and she wouldn't have it. So I was going to make sure she bloody well did have it. The full details, which she didn't know 100% all the details about. I'd had a couple of drinks, so I made sure she was told. But afterwards, as
made sure she was told. It's brutal.
I know it sounds terrible, but
I hadn't had the pleasure of getting to know Roger Federer.
No, but it didn't.
Then or now.
But it didn't stop you telling me exactly what was what at the time. So I decided to give you the facts. Or at least my experience of the person that I knew. And
still stomped up the stairs a year later, yeah, during the Broderick Wimbledon
but after
final.
But after that, and since that, I did think, actually, as angry as I was, that was quite entertaining. So there we are.
I think I realised how angry you were.
No, I mean, that's probably the most angry I'd ever been with you at that point.
Right.
So, I'm over it now.
567 episodes later.
11 years later. Goodness. I mean, I'm still cringing. And now when I watch that, in obviously, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing and context is everything, nuance is everything. But when I now watch the YouTube clips of the crying on Rod Laver's shoulder thing, obviously I tear up within a split second and my bottom lip's going and I can't make it through any of it. And yeah,
that was the bit that was winding me up, is because there was publicly available evidence and you wouldn't accept it, so I was just going on about it until you did, and eventually I won. So and then
I'm starting to feel tension, like we're getting the WhatsApp group.
Did you notice why Catherine didn't answer that? Yeah. She just sort of looked at you.
Sometimes now I get not at David at all, but I just like, I unleash my rage at something external on the WhatsApp group, and I know what's happened is that David has texted Matt separately and said, don't respond to her, Matt, it's moth to a flame, don't. just let her simmer for a while. I know what's happened.
It's out of her system. It's all right. Just put your phone away.
It all
away.
Goes really quiet, and I'm like, oh, I thought I made a really good point there. I thought this would stoke up some really great conversation. Yeah. I thought
a lot of the time we don't understand it, or I don't anyway. She's a bit cleverer than me. So yeah, we well, how many episodes have we done? 560 odd. So I guess we get on right most of the time.
Yeah.
Right, so
shall we wrap it up?
Yeah, okay. On that note, we will bring a conclusion to the 566th episode of the Tennis Podcast, or whatever it is, and the tennis podcast in general has come to a close after 8 years of production. And Catherine and I...
I was just getting started.
Can finally go and talk to people we want to talk to. No, we get along famously most of the time, as does Matt with us. And thank you, Alex, for your questions. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Alex, for your support to our Kickstarter in December that has enabled us to produce as many shows as we have over the course of 2019 to date. We have not finished yet, folks. We will be weekly throughout the year up until the US Open. Then we'll be daily throughout the US Open, of course. And we've got some other plans as well for the autumn, when we really want to keep pushing as much as we can and produce as many shows as we can. And then in December, we'll be crowdfunding for 2020 once again. We have a little list that you can join up to if you want to have a reminder on December the 1st when we are running our Kickstarter to crowdfund 2020. So it's in the show notes to this show. So just scroll down and you can press on that if you want to get... It'll only be a single email. You won't get spam loads unless you're on the newsletter, in which case you will get a daily newsletter every day throughout the US Open, which will include our predictions, as if you haven't had enough of them, and Matt's stat. But this has been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by tennisballs.com, and with our mascot Rio with a Y. We'll see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.